Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
It is the day after the meeting. President Trump is in the air and he's on his way back to Washington. He should be on the ground about 2 hours from now. On this Thursday, it is the 30th of October, if you can imagine that, a rainy day here in the nation's capital, as the president comes back home from South Korea and the Senate heads for the hills after another less than fruitful week in keeping the government open. We are now closed for 30 days. With, again, no signs of this ending. So thanks for joining us here on the Thursday edition of Balance of Power here on Bloomberg TV and radio. The meeting lasted an hour and 40 minutes, roughly, between President Trump and President Xi. All of the president's lieutenants were there. Lutnick, Besant, Rubio, Greer, Wiles, even Perdue, yes. The ambassador to China, David Perdue, was there. And within an hour of that meeting ending, the president was on Air Force One talking with reporters. This was the first readout that we got on what happened. Listen to Donald Trump.
I thought it was an amazing meeting. He's a great leader of a very powerful, very strong country, China. And what can I say? We have, it was an outstanding group of decisions, I think, that was made, and we've come to conclusion on many very important points.
Many important points. He called the meeting a 12 out of 10, but we're still trying to figure out exactly what was accomplished beyond the one-year truce. The president is cutting tariffs on China by 10% immediately, 57 to 47%, with a nod to China's attempt to apparently interfere with the fentanyl trade, though we haven't seen details on that. The new threat of an additional 100% tariff is now off the table in exchange for access to rare earth minerals. Soybeans will be sold. This might be the most specific takeaway that we have. 12 million tons of soy for this year, 25 million a year going through 2028, according to Brooke Rollins, the ag secretary. And the president is going to go to China in April, is at least the plan for now. That remains a long way off. But we have huge questions about so many things from NVIDIA. Remember yesterday we were talking about selling Blackwells in Beijing. No agreement there. President says Taiwan did not come up. And nothing was hammered out on TikTok, generating the headline on the terminal, Trump Xi truce buys time as both seek leverage in broader fight. Or as Terry Haynes at Pangea Policy put it in his note to clients, you'll get a truce and you'll like it. Let's go to South Korea for more. Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall's been there all week for the negotiations with Seoul and now Beijing and joins us with a live update. Tyler, what else do we know?
Hey, Joe. Well, you really set this up perfectly. We are seeing this easing in tensions. But at the end of the day, the root causes that led to this standoff between the U.S. and China really haven't been resolved, particularly around national security, the greater issue of unbalanced trade. And of course, as both countries are jockeying for dominance when it comes to the tech sector. Now, you laid out some of the deliverables that we did get this meeting. We should keep in mind that there's actually a broad array of tariffs on China imposed by the U.S. Some are from a Section 301 investigation into unfair trade practices. Others are Section 232 tariffs enacted on sector in specific. But then some are related to fentanyl, that 20% tariff related to fentanyl now being cut in half. But as you mentioned, we are going off of a pledge President Trump said that he got from Chinese President Xi Jinping to curb what's known as those precursor chemicals that go into the drug. And then lastly, there's that so-called reciprocal tariff rate that's been on China. It had the threat to be ratcheted up. Now it is going to be extended at 10% for at least a year. So that's how we get that aggregate 47% effective U.S. tariff rate currently in place. But then some of those other deliverables that we got really just feel like we are getting a pullback in recent escalation from just the past few weeks, right? China now committing to soybeans, purchasing 12 million tons through the end of this year, 25 million tons for the next 3 years. Worth mentioning that 25 million ton number is in line with what U.S. farmers would be expecting to export during that time. So that is welcome news, of course, for American farmers. But those other provisions, threats from the U.S. to impose fees on Chinese ships docked at American ports, for example, that has also come off the table. So, Joe, I think that you framed it really well. This is an easing of tensions. It is welcome. But at the end of the day, it feels like we are mainly pulling back on the escalation from really just the past few weeks alone.
Fascinating. Tyler, there was talk of a energy deal in Alaska that China would be buying oil and gas. The president says Chris Wright, Doug Burgum and our respective energy teams, according to his Truth Social post, will be meeting to see if such an energy deal can be worked out. So nothing is on paper yet, right?
Nope, not yet. And the Energy Secretary Chris Wright was on Bloomberg Television this morning, did confirm that he has a trip coming up. He said it actually might happen sooner than previously expected, but we did not get any more details here. Of course, as you well know, the administration has been pushing to streamline and deregulate when it comes to permitting and drilling in Alaska to get more American barrels overseas. So it's something we're going to be watching closely because President Trump, up to this point, hasn't taken punitive action against China when it comes to their imports of Russian energy supplies with, say, a so-called secondary tariff like we've seen implemented against India. And China is the top importer of Russian energy crude. In fact, Russian barrels make up about 20% of China's import of crude in general. So a huge market for them as this really has been a central component to helping the Kremlin fund the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, great stuff. Tyler, we're so lucky to have you there. Tyler Kendall, still in South Korea for the aftermath of the APEC summit and President Trump's meeting with President Xi. We'll have more from Tyler as we make our way through the day here and the president makes his return to the U.S. Clutch analysis from the former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. He talked to David Westin just a short time ago following the meeting. Here's what he said.
I think the most important thing is what didn't happen. This situation didn't spiral out of control into massive confrontation and economic conflict. And it was managed in a way that avoided what potentially could have been very unfortunate and destabilizing outcomes. And that's the good news. And I think it genuinely is good news.
Glass half full. Let's see what Mary Lovely is pouring, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. We had to talk to Mary knowing the importance of this meeting, and it's great to have you back with us, Mary, on Bloomberg TV and radio. We can say a lot about what was not accomplished or what didn't happen. Yes, we don't have an international crisis this morning, but we don't have a lot of details either. How are you reading this meeting?
Well, and it's a little bit sense of back to the future. We, you know, a lot of this conflict was stirred up by President Trump in attempts to gain some leverage. China showed a very strong weapon in its rare earths exports. And I think the U.S. blinked. So I think that, the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers is right. We don't have an escalation, but I think the reason that we don't have an escalation is because that the U.S. realized that it was not in a good position. I think we're seeing an asymmetric, response to this, which is that China is doing everything it can to reduce its dependence on the United States. It has been for some time. And the U.S. is focused on short-term deals. And I think that that asymmetry is not going to serve us well moving forward.
Wow. All right. Well, there's your headline from Mary Lovely. The U.S. blinked. You said a couple of things there as well. Back to the future is not the first time I've heard that line. And I was trying one out earlier. Mary, is this not the proverbial putting on a really tight pair of shoes and celebrating how good it feels to take them off?
Yeah, I think that is apt. I think that we are happy that the shoes are off. There is no doubt about that. 100% tariffs on China simply would do nothing good, only bad things for the U.S. economy. That doesn't mean that China would be spared either. They are being hurt by this, but they're in a very different situation, different political system. I think the Chinese feel very good about where they are, about the use of the rare earths. I think right now we've sort of seen the big weapons put back in the holsters, but as your correspondent has noted and others have noted, this is really by no means a settling of the really big issues that are out there. And those issues, I might add, have really changed since Trump won, since the issues that were dealt with in the original Section 301 report that was the basis for the trade war that started back in 2017. Today, we're looking at very, very difficult issues on really decoupling for national security purposes and doing that in a way that really minimizes the negative effect on the U.S. economy and on the economy of our alliances. So there is some really serious difficult issues ahead. I think soybeans are important to farmers, but you know, for China, this is just another chit that it can turn on and turn off.
Okay, well, so that's my question. You mentioned 2017. We've got a deal here to buy at least 12 million tons of soybeans rest of the year, then 25 million a year through 2028. Does history show us that China will actually do this?
I think it depends on U.S. activity. You know, President Trump has shown a penchant for, suddenly one day something upsets him and he's got 100%, 140% tariff on China. If he does so, he knows that 25 million bushels of soybeans are at play. So in a sense, that gives another tool to China.
Do we believe that Taiwan, quote, never came up, unquote, as President Trump said?
It's highly possible. I think right now we all benefit from as little attention to Taiwan as possible. A continuation of the status quo, I think, is in the long-term interests of global economic stability. So if it didn't come up, I think that's probably good. We are focused on very short-term issues here. And again, it's important that this was resolved and resolved quickly. But that doesn't mean that in any sense we're not looking at a rocky road ahead. Now, that road doesn't have to be rocky, but it has to be serious and it has to be deep in thinking about the cost benefit on where we really need to decouple in some sense from China. What are the parameters for tech integration? You know, Joe, you mentioned that we hadn't heard anything about the TikTok deal. The Chinese media and scholars were looking to see what the parameters there were that were going to be acceptable to both sides. We had a teaser on Blackwell chips. What is the acceptable level of integration? This is important because we're moving very, very quickly into the AI era where China is going to be very competitive in embodied intelligence, the things that use AI to bring those productivity improvements to fruition. Where are we with being able to purchase those and allow our allies to purchase those?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned NVIDIA because the market was breathless about Blackwell's yesterday. It sent NVIDIA stock to a new high. People couldn't believe it. How could this suddenly be on the table? What's going to happen? It's potentially so irresponsible. We had Republicans and Democrats from the Senate saying so on the program last evening, and then nothing. China will talk to NVIDIA and others, the president said, about buying more high-tech computer chips, and that's a good thing. Where are we going with NVIDIA?
I think we're seeing tensions within the administration on how we are going to approach the national security concerns, particularly around advanced chips, something that we thought we were, controlling to the best of our ability. And it was always, as you know, Joe, very imperfect. China was still getting access to a lot of the most advanced chips. But we saw a big escalation a few weeks ago when the Trump administration moved to put the foreign affiliates of Chinese companies on the entity list. On the entity list themselves, something that expanded those lists by close to 20,000 firms. The Chinese obviously reacted not very negatively and came out with a series of export controls of their own, which would have been deeply destabilizing. We saw a little bit of rollback of those. President Xi has said that he's not going to put really what are controls on third-party sales of goods that contain rare earths, but they maintain their licensing system. So what was that about? What was this escalation in the middle of negotiations by Secretary Bessent and his team with the Chinese, and then the president teasing on the Blackwell chips? So again, I don't think we have much clarity on where these lines are going to be drawn.
We've got about a minute left here, Mary. The president will travel to China in April, he says, with further talks in store with President Xi. Apparently, Xi has agreed to a return trip further down the line. These are months away. What will need to happen for Donald Trump to go back to China, and could that generate an actual deal?
I could. They have to. I think the American team has to decide where they're going to make these compromises and not provide any more easy wins to the Chinese. The Chinese have always had, in a sense, short-term escalation dominance, as Adam Posen has written. And here we need to really be careful not to give them any more tools. And that means that the U.S. needs to continue to do the hard work of raising its own economic resilience. And we're starting to do that, looking for alternative deals on critical minerals. But we know those are something that can't be just snapped into place.
Yeah. Boy, we've got a lot to figure out still, I think. And it's great to have you back, Mary. Let's keep this conversation rolling, certainly until next April. Mary Lovely, Peterson Institute for International Economics, a fascinating conversation. And we thank you for joining us. That'll be on the podcast. I'm Joe Matthew. This is Bloomberg.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're looking at you from Washington with our eyes on New York, and we're going to be up there next week. I hope you'll join us with special coverage on Election Day as we balance races in New York, New Jersey, Virginia. We've been talking about them as they, according to some at least, play into this government shutdown, or maybe it's the other way around. We'll find out together next week whether the elections themselves bring any off ramps. But the polling is what has us compelled today, because we've been getting a lot of numbers recently on the New York mayoral race, and they just don't agree, which is making us wonder where this race actually is. If you ask the good people at Emerson College, their polling institute, they'd tell you there's a 25-point lead for Zohran Mamdani. And that's the type of number we've been hearing, right? 20-30%. It's going to be a blowout, they say. Get ready for an early night. Then you ask Marist College, well, they've got a 16-point lead in a three-way race for Mamdani. Okay, that's a little bit more restrained, and we're putting these up on the screen for you so you can play along on your home game. The Quinnipiac University poll out today, however, shows us 43% of likely voters support Mamdani, putting him only 10 points ahead of Andrew Cuomo. Let's play it to the panel and get their sense here. Lisa Camuso-Miller is with us today, Republican strategist, no stranger to New York and New Jersey politics, former RNC communications director and senior vice president with Rock Solutions. She's the host of the Friday Reporter podcast. Megan Hayes is with us as well, Democratic strategist and former special assistant to President Biden. Great to have you both here. Lisa, I'll start with you in your old backyard. What do you do when you're trying to read a race that has this much noise in the polling numbers? I'm sure that most campaigns would be very happy with a double-digit lead, but that's a far cry between 25% and 10% for Mamdani.
They're still pretty good numbers, though, Joe. I think it's going to come out to turnout. Sounds like early voting is really happening strong in a lot of the, I mean, sounds like Brooklyn is really leading the race here. Staten Island and the Bronx are also lagging behind. So it's going to come down to what the issues are. And the issues are street safety and economic stability. And those are the ones that are really going to be interesting to see who comes through. But, my money has got to still be on Mamdani all the way, even though Cuomo really does have an operation. He has a political operation that he's used and used well over time. New York City is a far different animal than New York State.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think of these numbers, Megan? How do you spell blowout? 10% or 25%?
I think anything, you only have to win by one vote. So I think that he's, you know, these polling numbers, if there are any indicators, are showing that he'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And it will be probably be an early night. I do think it's interesting that you do see some more business people and more the wealthy class of New York City starting to sort of get a little bit anxious, and you see them getting more involved, more commercials going up. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a little too late for that, but I do think the early vote is, the numbers are already staggering to what they have been in the past.
Well, let's talk about Andrew Cuomo here for a moment, who, by the way, was endorsed yesterday by Michael Bloomberg. To be clear, in the New York City mayoral race, Michael Bloomberg has also donated to a super PAC supporting Cuomo. And Michael Bloomberg is, of course, the founder and majority owner of Bloomberg LP, the parent company of Bloomberg TV and radio. So here we are. Whether endorsements matter in this case could be its own show here, Megan, but we're looking at a world in which moderate Democrats and Republicans are warming up to the idea of Andrew Cuomo as mayor. Could it make a difference?
I just think it's a little too late. And yeah. I think a three-person race, it's interesting because people wanted Curtis Sliwa to drop out, but I'm not sure yes. that really makes a difference if Republicans are going to vote for somebody or they're going to vote for Cuomo. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's a little too late. I mm-hmm. think that maybe if we were having this conversation 3-4 weeks ago, we might see a different outcome next week. I just think that the clock is running out here.
What would you tell Andrew Cuomo to do as a Republican strategist, Lisa, to try to get those votes over the next couple of days?
I mean, he's got to continue to talk about stability. I mean, Republicans, the market, New York City, they like stability. They like to know what to expect. And they like to know that someone that can come into that office can actually make a difference. So that's the message that Cuomo, I think, has been resoundingly using over and over again. Experience, experience, experience. Voters in New York have made this decision before. I mean, we've seen the last two mayors that were elected there were unconventional candidates. I think New York likes to switch it up. And I think Mamdani's going to be just fine on election night. But if I'm Andrew Cuomo, I'm talking about stability and I'm talking about predictability, because that's, I think, what people want to see, especially with a president that represents a little less of that.
Interesting. In terms of other endorsements, Tom Suozzi, even Mike Lawler, the Republican, has endorsed mm-hmm. Andrew Cuomo. Pretty fascinating to consider where we're at here. When Mike Lawler is endorsing Andrew Cuomo, what does that say about the race? I guess it's a statement more on Mamdani than it is the former governor.
That's a vote against Mamdani, yeah. not for Andrew Cuomo. And I think that's a lot of what people are doing. It's very similar to what you saw Democrats do in 2024. They voted mm-hmm. against Trump, not necessarily for Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of parallels there. But I mean, their numbers aren't there for Cuomo to win at this point. But I do think it's important for people who do not believe in his views to endorse somebody else. I think you just shouldn't always go along with your party just because. So I do have a lot of respect for Tom Suozzi and for Mike Lawler for coming out and endorsing Cuomo.
Yeah. Well, all right. So, you know, the real stuff comes down sometimes to how local you can get. Lisa, you reminded us in the New Jersey gubernatorial race that the difference between pork roll and Taylor ham could, in fact, declare the winner in this race between Mikey Sherrill.
I'm not sure that it was whether she
You can stop me if you want. It was knowing which was rich. So I'm going to ask you again. You remember in the last debate for New York mayor, they were asked at the end, what is your breakfast bodega order? We're going to have to see if we can pull this out here. We can't use it? All right, I guess I'll get sued if I play that. Mamdani had a different answer than the other two. I think it was something on a bagel. It was egg on a bagel with jalapenos. I'll have
no
to go
salt.
Back and read this.
With no salt.
That was Andrew Cuomo when Sliwa had no salt. But guess what? Yeah. He just landed. Mamdani landed the United Bodegas of America endorsement. Lisa, is this thing shut down?
I don't know that that makes a difference, but those are a vote from small businesses that are looking at a candidate mm-hmm. that they think can make a difference for them. And that's where that makes a difference, I think, more than anything, because that city is full of small business owners who really want a mayor yep. that can help make change.
Egg, cheese, jalapeno. Thank you, Cece. Not just small business but small businesses owned and operated by immigrants.
Yeah, actually, I think that's actually really interesting for someone who wants government-run grocery stores. That the bodegas, the union for the bodegas is coming
out. Which they opposed initially.
Exactly. So I do think that is a really interesting dynamic here. But I also think they see the writing on the wall. They're reading the same polls we are. And they also know that they're going to have to work with Mindami's office. They're going to have to rely on him for different regulations.
Great point.
Mm-hmm. All sorts of things that the city government is responsible for. So it's a smart play, political play by them.
Yeah. Lisa, this is going to take place, of course, the same day that we have elections, as I mentioned, in Virginia and New Jersey. Are you in the same place when it comes to Cittorelli in New Jersey?
Yes, I am. I'm still watching it closely, and I think that it's going to be a very close race in New Jersey. New Jersey never disappoints. It's always down to the last minute. But I think it's going to be a good night for Democrats, and I think that I hope for them that they don't over-index on the fact that they were successful, because it's less about their candidates, more about the issues, and they're going to have to pay very close attention to what this means for the midterms.
I think you're expecting a blowout for the Democrat in Virginia, Abigail Spanberger. How about New Jersey? How come Mikey Sherrill is not doing better right now?
I think just like what Lisa was saying, I think affordability issues, and I think that those are really hard issues to break through. And I know she's really leaned into the energy prices. I know she's leaned into some child safety issues. I think the Trump factor here is really important. I think Cittorelli was really hanging his hat on Trump, and I do think that is concerning for a lot of Democrats and people. Just the crazier things that Trump does, the worse it is, I think, when you're in these some of these states for the midterms. But I do agree with Lisa. Dems need to be really careful here. If they are victorious, like it is showing that they might be, they need to really watch and really hone in on those affordability issues leaning into the midterms and not just get comfortable.
Understood. Did she have the energy, the charisma? Is she the right candidate? Because there's been a lot of questions about candidate quality here.
I think she's great, and I think that she will be a great governor. She is very moderate. She knows what she's doing. She will govern on day one. I think she is a new generation for Democrats. She has a national security background. She brings different style of leadership, and that's okay. And the Democratic Party needs that. And I welcome her, and I welcome Abigail Spanberger.
Yeah.
If they both are victorious, I think they are great leaders to look forward to for our party.
Anyone who's living in Virginia also, or the D.C. area, looking forward to these ads coming down. Lisa? So where will New Jersey be decided?
I think I'd pay very close attention to North Jersey, right in the shadows of Wall Street, where folks live. I mean, Bergen County will always go Republican, but some of those other northern counties went for Trump last go around. And so that's going to be where we're going to have to watch and see. The other thing, too, Joe, I'd like to point out is that this is the first time in my history that I can ever remember that two females would lead the governor's office if, in fact, they both win on Tuesday.
How about that? Producer James reminds us, the Emerson poll that I mentioned for the New York mayoral race has numbers on New Jersey gubernatorial. Sherrill is 49-48 over Cittorelli. Is that how close this race is?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's going to be extremely close. She might be more than 1 point, but it is going to be close, and it will not be called right away. You know how some of these are just called right when the polls close. I think it's going to go 10, 11, maybe even midnight. So I think that Virginia and New York will be called much earlier, but I think we're in for a little bit more of a wait for New Jersey.
You see this as a 1 point contest, Lisa?
I think it can be very close. I mean, Joe, I hate to say it out loud, but it's the kind of thing. Last time Jack Cittorelli ran for governor, he was so close that they had a recount. So I think that there's going to be a lot of, it could be a late night. We could be well into days after the election. That's how close I think it's going to be in New Jersey.
Well, this is going to be a riot. And as I mentioned, we'll have special coverage. That'll be next Tuesday live from New York here on Balance of Power. Many thanks to our great panel. This is a great conversation and fun to get ready for these elections with Lisa Camuso-Miller and Megan Hayes. We thank you both. We've got another breaker here on the terminal. The FAA has just issued a ground stop for Washington Reagan National Airport. It's not a mechanical problem this time. They say it's due to staffing. So here we are. We have arrived, and we'll have more on this coming up when we spend some time with Congressman Jake Auchincloss, the Democrat from Massachusetts. Up next here on Balance of Power, only available on Bloomberg TV and radio.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We've got a ground stop, another one. At National Airport, Reagan National here in D.C., that's DCA if you want the airport code, and it's not new. We've been seeing a lot of ground stops there. Yesterday, there was one, in fact, that was blamed on military activity. Today, it's a different matter. it's due to staffing. And this is something that we had feared. Many have predicted that we begin seeing ground stops at airports around the country because of the government shutdown, remembering that air traffic controllers are not being paid. Many are working 60 hours a week, already were, and suddenly they're doing so without a paycheck. Of course, they will be made whole, presumably, when this is over. But the unions are already squawking, and we have seen some slowdowns at airports. We've seen a lot of delays and cancellations, but not a full-on ground stop like this, certainly in the nation's capital due to staffing. This is going to be the subject of a meeting taking place today at the White House, by the way. There's a live view of National Airport if you're with us on Bloomberg TV. J.D. Vance, the vice president, will be holding forth with the CEOs of American and United Airlines, and will also be with Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. And Chris Sununu, who now runs, as he told us in person on a recent edition of Balance of Power, the airline trade group, that will all be part of this conversation today. Whether something comes from this in terms of a new policy or a way to pay air traffic controllers is another matter. But it's where we start our conversation with Congressman Jake Auchincloss, the Democrat from Massachusetts, importantly serves on the Committee on Energy and Commerce, which oversees the FAA, among many other important entities. And he's with us now on day 30 of the government shutdown. Congressman, it's good to see you. How concerned are you, or maybe you can even tell us based on what you're hearing, of more events like these happening around the country?
Inevitable. The air traffic controls have been warning about this. They're working without being paid. Contrast that with Speaker Johnson, who's being paid without working. The Speaker needs to call the House back into session. I will go to Washington today, probably by train, not by airplane, and start negotiating with Republicans. Before this shutdown, I offered a series of proposals to get to yes, from reversing the worst of the Medicaid cuts, to funding local law enforcement, to giving Congress a vote on tariffs. And it's been radio silence since then. The president and Republicans are in charge. This is their responsibility.
Well, you know, it's something. The House has been out, you probably know more than I, better than I, Congressman, I think 45 days since before the government actually shut down, having passed the clean CR. And the Speaker's rhetoric remains the same. We've done our job. You let us know, United States Senate, when you're ready to do yours. But we have heard that John Thune is preparing to start talks with some rank and file Democrats. Do you have any sense that that's true or when that might start?
I do think that's true. And we need to get to yes. And again, the proposals that I and other Democrats in the House put forward are not partisan proposals. I mean, allowing Congress to vote on the tariffs, which have been the biggest tax hike in modern American history and that were imposed unilaterally and illegally by the president, is not exactly like a lefty talking point. I mean, that is just right down the middle of constitutional governance and the middle class.
Tell us more about what's happening in the air traffic control towers and what could be done to prevent massive closures. You said it's inevitable that we'd see things like this. Can anything be done to contain these ground stops at airports if, in fact, controllers stop showing up?
I don't want to conjecture. What I can say from my time talking to air traffic controllers when I was on Transportation and Infrastructure, the committee with jurisdiction, is that when you have these government shutdowns, the air traffic controllers will start taking other types of jobs to make ends meet and will call out in order to go to those other jobs. They got to put food on the table for their family. They got to make rent. And that will lead to staffing shortages, which creates unsafe conditions, which creates ground stops.
And here we are with potentially more in the offing. Does November 1st matter anymore, Congressman? That's open enrollment, of course, and potentially the end of some SNAP benefits, the beginning of the end. But now there are efforts to try to overcome those legislatively, at least in terms of the SNAP benefits, as another potential pain point is taken off the calendar. What do you think is going to happen when we get into the new month?
Yes, it matters. The president calls it a Democrat program, SNAP. It's not. It's a program for children. Two-thirds of the recipients of SNAP are families with children. This is about kids going to school with a full belly. And illegally withholding those SNAP funds is callous and cruel.
Your governor's taking action on this, right? Is Maura Healey going to manage to bridge the gap here? Obviously, we don't know how long the gap might be, Congressman, but it looks like a lot of governors, a lot of states are stepping up.
Governor Healey's always stepping up, whether it's backfilling science funding, whether it's energy after the president arbitrarily canceled offshore wind permits, now with SNAP benefits. She's always patching holes and protecting Massachusetts, but she can't cover the full gap on SNAP. No governor can. This is a federal program. It's federally funded. It needs to be federally delivered.
As we spend time with Congressman Jake Auchincloss, we want to tap your experience, Congressman, when it comes to geopolitics and the Pentagon. Of course, you are a combat Marine veteran, and we'll remind our audience that you commanded an infantry in Helmand Province in Afghanistan in 2012, as well as a reconnaissance unit in Panama in 2014. The president yesterday, before he sat down with President Xi, took to Truth Social to talk about resuming nuclear tests here in the United States. I suspect you saw this. It's a pretty big deal, directing the Pentagon to test nuclear weapons for the first time since 1992. We're unfortunately not sure exactly how this is going to work, though. He said that testing should occur, quote, on an equal basis, unquote, with Russia and China. Is this a smart move, and what would it accomplish?
Nothing. He's trying to saber rattle to distract from the fact that he started a trade war with China, and American farmers are now losing it, because soybeans are more fungible than rare earth minerals. And so China gained leverage over the United States rapidly this summer and has now used it to cause Trump to tuck his tail between his legs. And as he always does, he's trying to strongman his way out of that perception. Anybody who's paying attention sees it. Now, here's what he should have done. He should have embarked upon a bipartisan industrial policy focused on American energy dominance, adding 2 to 4 quads of energy production per year, including the necessary control over rare earth supply chains. Number two, he should have used targeted sanctions and tariffs for the fentanyl export issue and for critical industries, and Congress has a lot of bipartisan legislation for that. And then finally, he should have inked a TikTok deal, again, according to congressional statute, that it gives Americans control over the most important media and information platform in the world. He has failed to do all three of those things. And so now he's trying to blow stuff up to make himself look tough. It's not going to work.
Are you encouraged that Blackwell chips were not part of any deal making yesterday?
Well, I mean, the president took a stake in NVIDIA's export of chips to the Chinese Communist Party. So he's literally trying to give the U.S. government like equity in equipping China to leapfrog us in AI inference. It's wow. His version of state-directed capitalism is going to enrich his family, that's for sure, with their crypto schemes, probably $5 billion worth. But it's not going to be good for America Incorporated. All it's going to do is sow further uncertainty amongst investors and entrepreneurs, when what these investors and entrepreneurs really need is abundant, clean, cheap, reliable energy. And this president has been inhibiting rather than amplifying that. That should be our industrial policy. Forget all of this crony capitalism. Focus on American energy.
We could do a whole show on this, Congressman. This is fascinating to me. When it comes to the likes of NVIDIA, Jensen Huang would say, hey, if we want to win the AI race in this country, you need to get the world on the AI stack. And that, of course, runs counter to folks like yourself. Your opinions on this, where providing some of the highest end AI chips to China would in fact be a national security violation. Is Jensen Huang simply wrong about this?
I think Jensen Huang is talking his own book, which is what a private company CEO is going to do. The president of the United States should be looking in a long-term way about American competitiveness. And the most important questions about how the U.S. outcompetes China in science and technology are not about China. China's got 1.3 billion people. Their kids are outperforming our kids on math and science scores. They're investing huge amounts in basic research. China is going to be a powerhouse. There's nothing we can do to prevent that. What we can do is double down on what's made this country a behemoth of free enterprise. We got to double the NIH and National Science Foundation budget. We got to attract the best and brightest from the world over. We got to protect intellectual property, guarantee a sound currency, expand global markets for our entrepreneurs. It's all the stuff that's simple but not easy. And this president is replacing it with, you know, Trump Incorporated, where if you want to do business in America, you got to buy his son's crypto coins.
You mentioned energy, Congressman. We're coming off the NVIDIA GTC conference this week here in Washington, D.C., and there's been enormous talk, of course, about harnessing clean, renewable energy for data centers that are popping up like weeds all over the country here. Some think the answer is nuclear, small modular reactors, but that could take some time. And so I'm wondering what it is you refer to. Is it natural gas? How do we get these data centers powered up without hiking electricity bills in the state of Massachusetts?
And electricity bills are going up double digits in Massachusetts and Virginia, in other states. It's going to be different in different states. Some places it might be hydro. Massachusetts offshore wind could have been part of the solution until the president canceled it. It's going to be natural gas in some areas. I think one common one, though, is next generation geothermal. You got companies like Quaise, which is doing millimeter wave drilling that can go 5 to 7 miles deep, which means that it's hot everywhere. You don't have to go to Iceland, right? Anywhere you dig or drill, it's hot. And that allows us to create high baseload, affordable, reliable electricity that is clean in states across the country.
You know, one thing that we haven't had a chance to talk about with regard to the government shutdown that ties into what we are discussing with regard to energy is heating oil assistance in Massachusetts. Yeah. It's getting to be that season to fill the tank, Congressman. It already is that season in Massachusetts. It's been in the 30s in the morning recently. In our remaining moment, what will this mean for assistance in your state?
The low-income heating assistance program is a mainstay for Massachusetts families. We should expand the program, as I've consistently advocated, and ensure that families are able to keep homes warm during a New England winter. But again, that's a short-term issue. In the long term, what we need is energy independence that comes from adding more supply onto the grid. In Massachusetts, our biggest problem is not transmission, it's generation. We need next-gen geothermal, we need nuclear, we need offshore wind, we need hydro from Quebec. We need all of it and more.
This is why he's on the Committee on Energy and Commerce. Congressman Jake Auchincloss, thank you, sir, for the time. It's good to see you. And we appreciate your insights here on Bloomberg. Democrat from Massachusetts, 4th District.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.